More than 50 million Americans feed birds. Are you one of them? Hi, I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is the Larry Mueller Show. And today we're talking about the book, 100 Plants to Feed the Birds. Turn your home garden into a healthy bird habitat. And back with us after way too long is Laura Erickson, and she's the author of 13 books about birds. And she's been recognized several times for her work. And most recently, the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology gave her the Golden Passenger Pigeon Award. What do you want to know about creating a bird-friendly garden? Are you looking for help with plant selection? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or send us an email, ideas@wpr.org. Laura, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
I didn't realize that you haven't been with us for like 7 years or so.
Yeah, it's been a long time.
It certainly has. So this book, it's a great book. It fills a niche. Where did you come up with the idea?
The publishers called me up and asked me to write it.
Well, that's kind of nice. You just have to do the work.
It was one of those Star Trek things where I wanted to say, darn it, Jim, I'm a bird watcher, not a botanist. But
that's true, but you are kind of combining there. Did you have to do a lot of learning about plants when you were doing this?
Well, I'd taken, you know, botany and forest management and all kinds of courses when I was in college, and I've always paid attention to the connections between plants and birds. But this book has a national scope, which meant I had to do a lot of research about issues in the Southwest, all kinds of things along both coasts. Some plants that belong on the Atlantic coast have become terribly invasive and destructive on the West Coast. So I've had to be pretty, I really wanted to go into everything well, and that took a year of research.
Well, I believe that because it is pretty comprehensive, really. I mean, it's only 100 plants. You could have probably picked a lot of them. Why did you decide on 100? Just sounded good?
Because that was written in stone before I even started writing the book. The publishers already have 100 plants to feed the bees and 100 plants to feed the monarchs. And ironically, bees and monarchs feed entirely on the plant material, the nectar and things, where the birds, many of these plants do not directly feed the birds. They feed the insects that the birds depend on. So we're using the term a little bit broader than maybe.
But it sounds good for the title anyway. So, you know, how do you respond to people when they say, well, I feed the birds. What else do I have to do?
Well, let's just look at the most popular bird at feeders, or at least the one we can most easily rely on, the black-capped chickadee. They do come to our feeders. They love our food. But even in the winter, even in a harsh winter, about half of the food they eat is insects that are not from our feeders at all. They get most of their food year-round, a vast majority in summer and fall, they get the vast majority of their food from plants and the insects on those plants, yeah.
And I was really interested when I was reading that these birds can find them in the wintertime. So how does that work?
Well, the bugs don't just arise out of nothing when the temperature thaws. There are eggs or pupae in little crevices in the tree bark and weeds, and birds just know where to look for the particular ones their species depends on.
So how do you even start this process? So I'm out here listening and my backyard is nice, but you know what? I'd like more birds. So where do I go from there?
Local native plant societies, Madison Audubon, there's all kinds of things in Wisconsin that can help people. What I did was broke down plants into coniferous trees, broadleaf trees, and then shrubs and different kinds of, the herbaceous plants. And I also talk to some extent about fungi and lichens. Up in northern Wisconsin, our northern perula, which is a little warbler, nests in the old man's beard or usnea lichens that are draped in trees. So I talk about all those plants that birds need. When it says 100, it's not 100 species. Oak is only one entry in 100 plants to feed the birds, but I talk about a lot of different kinds of oaks. So,
yeah, and you know, you're talking about an oak, obviously. It takes a very long time to mature. Is it helping even when it's, you know, 2 feet tall?
Oh, definitely. The cool thing about oak trees, their acorns are so vital to so many of our birds and mammals that we assume that acorns are the whole point of having oaks. But a great many insects depend on oaks, and a great many of our birds depend on the insects in the oaks, which the oak tree is starting to produce when they're still quite young.
And, you know, we're talking about food, but they give a lot of other things that birds need too, don't they?
Yeah, a lot of kinds of plants have offer, like Kirtland's warblers, which are just a few of them are actually in Wisconsin, not right this moment, but once they leave the Bahamas in the spring, some of them will be coming to Jack Pines in Wisconsin. And they only nest on the ground underneath the bottom branches of fairly young jack pines. So jack pines are supposed to be between like 5 and 15 years old. And that is the perfect place for female Kirtland's warblers to nest and raise their babies. If the jack pines are too young, they don't have those bottom branches, nowhere near enough shelter. When they get older than 15 or 20, the bottom branches have fallen off, and then there's not the shelter. So they need that kind of tree for their nest. Some kinds of birds, like pileated woodpeckers, or do you say pileated? Either works. But they prefer aspen trees if they're available, because aspen trees, I like to tell when I'm talking to little kids, I say, aspen trees are sort of like me. When they get into their 40s, and then I had to start saying their 50s and their 60s, and now their 70s.
Oh.
On the outside, they're still hanging together okay, but on the inside, heart rot has set in, and that starts decaying the tree from the inside out. And when the tree is decayed in the center, but the outer wood is still sturdy so that a pileated woodpecker can dig a hole the right size in the hardwood and then scoop out all that soft sawdust that the heart rot has produced, that will be the perfect place for a pileated woodpecker to make a roost hole or, more importantly, a nest. And they only use the nest for one season. After that, squirrels, saw-whet owls, all kinds of other things can take advantage of that cavity.
And when you're talking about like the plants that you're putting in, why is it so important to have native plants?
Not just Native American plants, but locally native plants. That is important because, first off, just for climate change issues and general water quality issues, locally native plants are the ones that need the least amount of watering, fertilizer, pesticides to keep normal insect, quote, pests away. They're the ones that are adapted to our local environment. They're the ones adapted to the insects our birds depend on. And so they're the right ones to plant.
That makes total sense. And in the back of your book, you do have for each state, you've got one, although there's probably many more than that, places where you can go to get information about that.
Right. The book is very thin, and so I could only put one per state, but there are many important resources to
and that's
go
a
through.
Great place to start. Now, talk about the book a little bit, what people can find in it when they pick it up.
I started out by saying it's the height of rudeness to invite your birds to a quality bird habitat if you're attracting them to a death trap. So I do talk about the issues of cats, and Wisconsin is the place where the central research about how bad outdoor cats are for birds originated, with Stan Temple's wonderful studies. But also our windows are death traps, and I talk about some strategies for making your windows bird safe. I talk a lot about that on my webpage, and the American Bird Conservancy has a lot of information about that. Then I talk about thinking about plants in terms of looking at your whole yard and not just picking out like one plant that hummingbirds will come to, like bee balm or something, because each plant may only have a narrow window of value over the time that the bird is there. So finding a structure, a bunch of different plants that will provide different values for different birds at different times is what to shoot for. And I talk about some invasive exotics that have to be rooted out because they're horrible, but how you can kind of ignore some. Norway spruces, at least where I am in Minnesota, people have planted them for many decades, but they aren't horrible. They aren't out competing anything. They haven't become naturalized up here. So if you have one already in your yard, don't go to the trouble to take it out to put in something native.
Well, you had mentioned too that sometimes natives can be invasive.
Yeah, the one really good example is junipers in scrub habitat in like where black-capped vireos or golden-cheeked warblers nest. They used to be balanced with things because things hardly ever reach the point of succession that we call climax vegetation. There would be too many fires in between that would burn out much of the juniper. So the other plants at earlier succession stages would be there. But because people have encroached upon so much natural habitat, the junipers take over in these critical habitats for endangered birds, and they need to be managed. That becomes a problem in our grasslands where we're trying to make sure we keep hang on to our greater prairie chickens. We have to be careful about non-grassland plants encroaching.
Definitely vigilance on that. So we were talking a little bit about more what you had in the book. I kind of got off on a tangent, but what else do you have in there, how people can use it?
I go through the plants group by group. Like within broadleaf trees, I have several kinds. Within conifers, I have several kinds. And then I talk about way of the birds that they are good for. I also do talk about homeowner issues that could be a problem, like their roots taking over your pipes or something.
Sure. And let's save that. We're going to go break for the news right now, and we'll come back and talk about more. We're talking to Laura Erickson. She's the author of 13 books about birds. Her latest is 100 Plants to Feed the Birds. What would you like to know about attracting birds to your garden? Well, we'd like to hear from you, so join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. We'll be back right after this look at the news. This is the Larry Mueller Show. I'm Jill Nadeau. We're talking with Laura Erickson. She's the author of 13 books about birds. And today we're talking about her latest, which is 100 Plants to Feed the Birds. Laura's also a scientist, teacher, writer, wildlife rehabilitator, and she produces a radio show and a podcast. You are a busy woman, Laura. And of course, we always want to hear from you. Do you have questions about plants that are good for birds? Or do you have a bird question for Laura? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, and you can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. org. Before we continue with the book, tell us about your podcast and radio show.
I started doing that in 1986 for some local stations. It's on some community stations in northern Wisconsin and in Minnesota, and as far east as Jamestown, New York, and in a couple of stations in California and Oregon. So, but it's called For the Birds. It's just about 5 minutes whenever I put one together now. So, last week I had a couple. This week I'll have three. Different weeks I talk about different things, either places I'm going to, interesting birds in the news, or whatever.
Yeah, that's great. That's something we should, our listeners will probably really enjoy listening to. So you can pick it up at a podcast wherever you get your podcasts from. So let's go back to the book. Let's get to the kind of the bones of what we should have in a bird-friendly garden, or as you say, how to birdscape your property, which I love that word. So what do we need to do?
We need to make sure we have plants that birds can sleep in at night. We call that roosting, and that can be really useful in the winter, especially. So conifers become important for that, either shrubbery or trees. And then plants that will provide a variety of insects, especially for during migration, for the little warblers and scarlet tanagers that may not live in your neighborhood when they are breeding, but will probably pass through in May. Things that offer nectar for orioles and hummingbirds. We think about all the different values that plants provide and then choose the ones that will work out best in our yard. Some of us do not have a yard nearly big enough to accommodate a white pine if your ultimate goal is to have bald eagles nesting. But there are a lot of choices of different size plants that could work for you.
Mm-hmm. What else do we need to provide? I'm thinking about water, right? That's a huge one.
Oh, water is a really important issue, and it has to do not just with what we're giving birds in our yards, but what will not be harming the water balance where we live. People in California, in a lot of places, just should not have bird baths at all or recirculating ponds if they use too much water. But unless they're getting their water from, say, a rain barrel, though that's a really good source for backyard water. If we do have bird baths or little ponds, we do have to be sure that we're not allowing those mosquitoes to take over that are the ones that are vectors for West Nile virus, which is much more lethal for some bird species than it is for people. And so making sure that bird baths are kept clean is very important. But also not keeping them clean by putting in algicides and other things that will hurt the birds,
right,
and defeat the whole purpose.
So what is the best method of cleaning a bird bath then?
Just changing the water every 2 to 3 days so the mosquitoes can't get a toehold in there. If they lay their eggs, the eggs won't have time to at least get through the larval stage and emerge. If you do it often enough, you don't even need to use a brush. But if you wait a little bit and start getting some scum along the edges, then it's good to use a nice stiff brush when you're changing the water, use it and hose it down pretty well.
What about in the winter? I know there's some items that you can use for that. That's important though too, right?
I always feel a little uncomfortable with the idea of offering water in winter if we have a heated bird bath, because I'm also looking at the issue of climate change and our carbon footprint. And birds do have many sources of water, even on the coldest days. And so I figure when I do offer water in the winter, what I do is just use a little plastic cereal bowl that I set out on my window feeder, and the chickadees and stuff know it's there and they come rushing in. But as soon as ice forms, I just take it in for the day so they can get a quick drink. But I watch on days like today, the birds are taking sips of water off the icicles. And even in when it was 20 below zero, they could pick up snow. And so they do get enough water even when it's pretty frigid.
We had mentioned a little bit about how to modify windows to keep birds from running into them. What are some of the best methods that you've used?
Whatever you put on the outside surface of glass to help birds notice it, there's a basic 2x4 rule. If you have vertical stripes of tape, you can use a magic marker or something on the outside, or put decals out. Side to side, they should be no more than 4 inches apart. That's a little narrower than most birds' wingspans, so they know they shouldn't fly through it. But if the lines are horizontal, birds can slip through more easily. So there, they should be no more than 2 inches apart. So if you have vertical stripes of something, one person, I have a good discussion of it on my website. That's just lauraerickson.com on ways to help. But he came up with the idea of what he calls Zen wind curtains, which are just made out of paracord suspended on the outside of the glass, 4 inches apart. And you can just put it on something. You don't even have to do much to your house. You can put it on a little curtain rod or on a dowel that's even held up by those suction cup bird feeder holders, so that it's about a couple inches out from the window, at least, usually about 4 inches out from the window. And the birds will see those and they won't fly between them. So they'll stay away from the window. Decals, if they're on the inside of the glass, are worthless if the glass is reflecting trees. So putting things on the outside is essential.
That's a really good point because, yeah, the reflection, I didn't even think about that myself. So that makes a lot of sense. And also in your book, you have these 100 plants and each one of them you give information about. So talk about what you give to people when they're reading it.
Well, I will discuss first of all that plant, whether it's a, you know, simple, pretty little flower like columbine or something like milkweed or something like oak trees. I give an overview of that group of plants' main benefits for birds. And then I talk about if there's caveats about them, like if their roots tend to get into pipes and or damage stuff, climbing plants, if they're the type that actually break down any cement or concrete. I talk about those things. And I talk about some of the recommended species. Obviously, I can't have all of them because there's too many plants. But I try to give people a good sense of whether or not they might want to look into that plant for their yard. And then you rush to your native plant nursery or somewhere to get more information.
That's true. And you've got pictures, little pictures of them to show you and with the birds in them. And I really like the map of the United States that shows you where these plants can grow, too. So you'll know that not necessarily some of those cactuses are not going to grow in Wisconsin. Some are, but
some will.
Prickly pear, for sure. So we're talking about birds' habitat, backyard habitat. Give us a call if you've got a question. I know we've got birders out there, but nobody's calling today. 800-642-1234. Again, 800-642-1234. We didn't talk about, pesticides and fertilizers, because that's something that's used in gardens all the time. That's probably not really good for birds, is it?
No. And that's, again, one of the main important reasons for only selecting locally native plants, because they're the plants that have evolved to survive in your local environment and without any kind of artificial interference. Fertilizers seem so innocuous, except they run off into our groundwater and into our lakes streams, and they lead to eutrophication, where we lose a lot of the oxygen levels in the streams where we should be having lots of mayflies, which need lots of oxygen there during their nymph stage, when they spend most of their lives in water. And mayflies are one of the fundamental insects that affect our populations of nighthawks, whippoorwills, and purple martins. Losing, you know, this insect apocalypse that people are so concerned about, that doesn't, you know, our backyard can affect things that don't nest within a mile of our backyard, like mayflies, but are so important for our backyard birds. So, and then the pesticides, you know, when they get through this, can seep through the soil and affect our groundwater. So those are things to shy away from.
Great. Thank you for that. We've got a phone call. Thank you. Lucia in Washburn, what question do you have for Laura?
Well, hey, good afternoon. I seem to miss the hummingbirds every year. I'll see them come into the backyard and think, oh, crud, I need to grab the feeder. And then they're here and gone and assume that I'm closed for business. So how often or how soon should we get those feeders out?
You can look online and follow either with eBird or hummingbirds.net. You can track their migration north so you can get your feeders out before they get to Washburn. But it's not just our feeders that draw them to our yards. First thing in the spring, hummingbirds can't count on nectar in flowers. Many times they're getting here while we're still getting frosts and things. But early in the spring, they're feeding in aspen trees and on the tips of spruce trees, grabbing little bits of the oozing sap and the tiny insects that are already emerging. And I had a rufous hummingbird in my yard a year ago arrived in my neighborhood in October, and it stayed in coming to my yard through December 4th. And there's cases in Wisconsin of an Allen's hummingbird sticking it out for a longer time than that. And mine survived the coldest nights and a couple of blizzards, but I could watch it even when the temperature was down around 20, taking insects in my weeds. You could just watch by the way it was darting in and out quickly that it was fly catching. So there are bugs out there that they can get. So you want to have very conspicuous hummingbird feeders to lure them to know they can have food in May. But the more plants that support what they need in early spring. If you have yellow-bellied sapsuckers in your neighborhood, they are like waving an Edith Joe's sign to the hummingbirds coming through because the oozing sap in their trees. One spring a few years ago, I was in Trempealeau and got my best pictures ever of Cape May warblers feeding at yellow-bellied sapsucker drill holes, and hummingbirds actually time their migration to arrive about 2 weeks after the sapsuckers have gotten to work.
Wow, that's really interesting. Well, hopefully that'll help you, Lucia. Just go to eBird, and you can kind of track where the birds are, that right, Laura?
Right.
It's a great website, so check it out. Let's go next to Don in Minnesota. Hi, Don.
Hi. Yes. Thank you for this question. We're wondering if there's buckthorn in Duluth and whether or not it is detrimental to birds.
Why?
And why?
Okay. Thanks, Don.
The reason we have so much buckthorn is specifically because birds love it. They pig out on it. It does not make them sick the way it does people. For people, it's actually been used as a purgative, but it doesn't have that effect on birds. So they pig out on it, then they fly somewhere else, and when they poop, out comes the buckthorn seeds that grow somewhere else too. So why is it a problem? Because buckthorn is so invasive that it crowds out the other kinds of shrubs that are also producing berries, but berries that will be available at different seasons than buckthorns are. Also, both buckthorn and Japanese honeysuckle, birds nesting in them have a much lower probability of bringing off their young than birds do nesting in native shrubs. There's a lot of studies now that have pretty clearly established it. The problem with buckthorn, if you have a bird-friendly yard, is that it's the birds that are planting it. And it's one of those that you just have to keep getting rid of over and over, because as long as you have birds, you're going to have buckthorn now. So it is a bad problem there. It's not toxic to birds, but it does invite them to nest in it. And then they're not likely to raise young the way they are in more native choice trees.
Right. And they're so invasive, and they just edge out all the native plants that are beneficial. So thanks for the question, Don. Let's go next to Jane in Madison. Hi, Jane.
Hi. My question is, I have peonies, and I know they're not native, and I'm wondering whether, you know, putting native seeds, planting native seeds amongst peonies that will come up later than the peonies blooms would work, or is it better just to get rid of the peonies?
Peonies are not a native plant, but they're also not an invasive plant that we have to worry about taking over the landscape. So if you love peonies, if you have cherry trees and depend on those cherries for all your pies, or other non-native ornamental plants, you don't have to panic about it. And your idea of adding native seeds to take over the peony bed after those blooms are gone is a great one. So that's the way you deal. As long as the plants you treasure that are not native are ones that are not causing any problems. If you have cherry trees, my husband loves sour cherries, and we've always had cherry trees, and he would put netting in the lower branches to keep the birds out of that, and they were out my window so I could be watching to make sure no birds got tangled, but he always left the upper part for the birds. I don't know of birds that use anything from peonies, but they're beautiful. My grandma loved them, so there's a place for them.
Yeah, they smell wonderful, but I would suggest, Jane, that you use actual seedlings rather than seeds, because I think you'll have much better luck with those. So thanks for the call, and good luck. Next up is Dave in Osseo. Hi, Dave.
Hello. Can you hear me?
We sure can. Go right ahead.
Oh, yes. My wife and I have been living off-grid now for 5 years near Osseo, near the edge of the Driftless region, in the tension zone, no less. And that it's just an area full of life. And I just wanted to, every day we learn something new about nature and the interplay between species. Just wanted to mention the cuckoo and the tent caterpillar. For years we had just tent caterpillars on all our cherry trees. And we did some investigation. It turns out, well, the cuckoo comes into the and usually clears them out. But if you lose a cuckoo couple, you might have to wait a few years to get rid of your tent caterpillars. And I just wondered if you'd heard of that, if you had any comments on that.
Thanks, Dave. Laura?
Yellow-billed cuckoos are the ones that eat a lot of the ones on cherry trees and backyard ornamentals and things like that, and also out in the countryside. Black-billed cuckoos, their numbers go crazy when we have a forest tent caterpillar outbreak. They are also called army worms, and it's the same thing. Cuckoos are specialized on eating those hairy caterpillars. There's enough cuckoos. They're one of the birds that are killed at windows, even though they do not come to our bird feeders. They're found under a surprising number of windows. And native caterpillars are what feed native birds. So tent caterpillars have an important role.
So we see these on tent caterpillars on our trees. Should we leave them or should we get rid of them?
Well, if they're regular native tent caterpillars, it's okay. But there's certain, now I can't remember the name of it, an invasive thing that looks quite a bit like them that is a problem. And when we get rid of them, it's kind of important to minimize any pesticides we'd be using on them. It's better to deal with the messiness of getting rid of the whole tent. But
well, get an ID. You could go to the Insect Diagnostic Lab, and they'll be able to ID that for you. Well, Laura, it's been so much fun talking with you and learning all about making a friendly bird habitat. We really appreciate you being with us.
It was great to be here, Jill. So nice to spend time with you.
Great. Thank you again so much. We've been talking with Laura Erickson about her new book. It's called 100 Plants to Feed the Birds, Turn Your Home Garden into a Healthy Bird Habitat. Well, tomorrow at this time, John Freiberger will be back to talk about ice buildup on your roof. Hope you can join us starting at 11. I'm Jill Nadeau, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Stay well.